Welcome to Browser's Bookshop, and this very special evening. And there are more of us than a normal evening in Browser's. So I do need to tell you that both doors are open now. If you do need to leave urgently, you can get out both ways. But thank you very much for coming this evening. I'm Catherine Lana, and I will be chatting with Sarah for this evening for about 40 minutes. But we will have plenty of time for questions, because I know that a number of you have been reading the book avidly, which is great. So you may have some burning questions that you'd like to ask her. So we'll have plenty of time for that. And then there will be the opportunity to have your book signed at the end as well. Of course. Okay, right. So where should we start? Well, as you all probably very familiar with the book, because it's been out a little while now. When was it
June.
Published?
June. Right at the end of June.
And you've had loads of publicity, great reviews and coverage.
Amazing. Yes.
And this is just one of a number of events that you've been doing. You've been all over the place.
I know. I never really, I kind of didn't really understand a publicist's job before now. And now I get why everyone, you know, reveres them so much, is because they do amazing things. And the reviews have been kind of incredible. I could not have asked for more. And I've been up to the Edinburgh Book Festival, which is daunting but fun. And I've got a London festival coming up, and have been in Bath and doing various kind of events. So it's been fun. And then the paperback is due for release at the end of January, so I think we're going to do another whirlwind around then as well.
Excellent. So tell us how it came about then, because you've been practicing in law for about 10 years.
Yeah.
And then you took a break.
Yeah.
From the law.
Yeah.
And decided to write a book.
Well, yeah, the pregnancy came first. So the break was slightly enforced.
Yes.
I found it very difficult to go back in between my two sons for a variety of reasons, but predominantly to do with the precarious nature of my job, which I'm self-employed, and there's always a sort of cash flow issue, as there always is with any self-employed person. So that, along with the genuine difficulty of being a trial lawyer, which means that your daily life is incredibly unpredictable, doesn't sit very easily with babies. I looked through our chamber's website, which has nearly 200 people in a really large chambers, and I tried to find somebody who had kids under school age who was in court every day, and I found one. And I emailed her and said, how do you do it? And she said, I have a husband whose job is incredibly flexible. His boss lets him work from home a lot, and he's there. I have a nursery down the road. It's open 8 till 6, and my mum lives around the corner. I thought, I don't have any of those things. So I thought, I knew that this break while my children were very small was probably going to involve being off for longer than I had necessarily anticipated. And I read English at university, and I did a creative writing dissertation. So I was trying to find a way out of the kind of morass of nappies and night feeds, and trying to find my sanity, and writing was a way to do that. So I wrote some blogs just to get my eye in, so to speak, and then spoke to a friend who had an agent who was trying to find a lawyer to write a legal version of Do No Harm. That was the pitch, which was something that I had been sort of very interested in, because I'd read the, it was at this time that there was a huge push of medical memoir writing, with lots of confessional type books coming out about the emotional side of a subject which is usually seen as quite dry and clinical, literally. And I could see how this would apply to law, but I never thought I'd write nonfiction. I always thought that I would, if I was going to apply my criminal and family experience, it would be with a fictional book. And then I met the woman who's now my agent, and she met various barristers, and she asked me to write a proposal, and then sold it. And then I found myself with a book deal and a 10-week-old baby. Mm. I met my editor for the first time when my baby was 10 days old, and then signed the deal. And then and then I had to write a book. But it was okay because then I could get childcare because I had an advance. So that was better. That was better.
Well, let's go back a bit then, because you've already mentioned that you enjoyed writing, and you did an English degree.
Yeah.
So how did the law come about? How did you decide to go into that as a profession, as your job?
It was quite a natural segue in the sense that it's all to do with words. I mean, I know I don't know that many lawyers who love the law, in the sense that they like the intellectual challenge and they like the linguistic challenge, but and of course the kind of principles behind it. But no one who would happily, not that many people who will happily kind of, you know, read case law all Friday night. I don't, I mean, there probably are, I just don't know.
But, so, don't mix with that time.
So I think it's actually quite, you meet quite a few people who have read a humanities subject in their law. It's quite a natural lead on. But I absolutely didn't think I was clever enough to do it, because I read all the career magazines that said you have to have a double first in Oxford or Cambridge and have a godfather who's a High Court judge and have to have law in your veins, otherwise forget about it. And you have to be a bloke. They also hinted at that. So I thought, well, this isn't going to work, because, you know, I grew up with two parents who hadn't been to university. They'd done, well, gone through teacher training college and now an agricultural college, but we didn't know any lawyers. Really, certainly didn't know any barristers. So that seemed very far removed. And then I went to university and did my English degree. And then it was a friend of mine, who appears in the book briefly, who said, you've just got to try it. You would be good at it. And I think the various kind of issues that you grapple with quite a lot, I've always been interested in. So she was the one who kind of said, what have you got to lose apart from a lot of time and money? So I took on those two challenges and moved back in with my parents when everyone else was going off to the bright lights, and got out a loan from NatWest and did a conversion. So 3 years of law squeezed into 8 months.
Which is really,
it's really intense. That was, yes, pretty intense. I found a geek I never knew I was. That was helpful. And I learned for the first time, and I was very cross that no one had taught me this before, how to learn things by rote.
Yeah.
Which was, I discovered, an entirely learnable skill, as was memorising stuff. So I taught myself to do that.
But you also immersed yourself in that world in different ways. I mean,
yeah.
You took on small jobs just so that you could
Absolutely
close to these people.
Yeah, well, that was before. So when I didn't think, when I didn't really think it was genuinely on the cards, I just thought, well, I just better get out there and see who does this and whether the magazines are all right and it is people who look like Rumpel. And so I'd been doing kind of secretarial work since I was 16, and I went back in to be a secretary, and even jumping from the secretarial pool into the legal secretarial pool was quite difficult, because you had to prove that you could spell affidavit and things like that. When I proved that I could, they then let me in. And then I ended up being a PA to the senior partner of a law firm, a local law firm. And that was very helpful, because I got some kind of practical experience of it. And at the same time, I got a job in a pub, because a pub I'd worked in as in various advisors since I was about 17, first as a housekeeper, and then in the kitchen, and then they slowly allowed me to move to the public-facing role behind the bar. And it was all very Machiavellian. I worked out, well, I'm never going to get into this through the traditional route, because I just don't have the contacts or the Oxbridge degree behind me. So the way I can do this is by showing that I, firstly, I'm really dedicated to it, and secondly, that I've got a lot of practical experience of it. And to get to the practical experience, I needed to meet people who were going to give me those opportunities. And so I didn't know any barristers, but I did know where they went to drink, and they went to drink in this pub. And so I said to the manager, I think I want to be a barrister, but I don't know any. And she was very on board and would just introduce me to all of them. And a lot of them would stay in the rooms above when they were doing big cases in the Crown Court. So that was That was very helpful. And a lot of them did look like Rumpel and sound like Rumpel, but then some of them didn't, and some of them were women, which was amazing. And the scales fell a bit, and then I got some work experience through some of the people I met there, and realised that although there are some who do have this extraordinary kind of background, there are others who are just normal and who are good at it. And the more people I met, the more I wondered if maybe this was something I could do. So I did all of that before I then took the leap to actually do the law conversion. So when I knew that it was, I felt it was more within my grasp than it had been before, I'd actually had all this practical experience. And that was incredibly helpful because I applied to a chambers when I had eventually done my bar course. I'd applied to a chambers in the city where I'd grown up, where I'd done all this work, so I had a lot of kind of contacts and so on. And I knew that I wouldn't kind of pass the computer test, but I might pass the kind of person test. So luckily I did.
Yes, good. But the conversion course, you said, is quite daunting anyway.
Yeah.
Cramming everything, but then when you actually get out there, you're thrown in there quite quickly.
You are, yeah. I think one of the common misconceptions I come up against is that it takes you a long time to become a lawyer, and it doesn't really. You do a law degree or you do a conversion, and the conversion is an academic year. Then you choose your path, whether you're going to become a solicitor or a barrister. That course, the sort of practical course, is a year. If you're going to be a solicitor, you then have 2 years of a training contract to get through before you qualify. When you're a barrister, you have to go to pupillage, but that is broken up into two lots of 6 months. The first 6 months are the hardest because you have to stay entirely silent and just follow around your pupil supervisor and try not to get in the way or say something stupid, or say anything at all, I think is the best advice. And then on the first day of your second 6 months, you are given your case and off you go. So it's quite quick.
So how did you feel?
Oh, it's absolutely... Well, you're dreading anyone going, so how long have you been doing this for? How long have you been doing this for? For a while, you dread that and try and bluster, hope that that question won't arise. But it is, you know, you. There is no better way to learn than being thrown in at the deep end.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. And okay, well, let's come back to the book then, because we need to come and look in a bit more detail at some of the cases that you presented there. But you've been asked to put together some of your experience in a book.
Yeah.
How did you decide the format that you were going to present it in and the content that you were going to include in the book?
Well, what I knew very clearly that what I wanted to do was to tell the stories of the people that I had met over 10 years. And that was because so often the stories are about the barristers and not about the people who they're representing. And most of the legal books I read... I couldn't find any that had been written by a woman. All of them had been written by men in their mid-40s. And I also found that so often it was about the kind of japes and capers of the bar and of the judges. And the person in the dock just got obliterated from that. They were the sort of vehicle for the rest of the action. And... quite very often that would be at their expense because they would end up being a two-dimensional character as the guy that jumped the dock or whoever it was be. And of course that's not who they are. And so I knew very clearly that I wanted to try and switch the beam around and shine it towards the back of the court rather than the front of the court. That was also motivated by the constant griping that takes place amongst barristers. We complain about how the press writes up cases, which is often in a headline which diminishes the complexity of a case to a single punch, and it's misleading. It can be misleading. So the facts may well be right, the facts may be accurately represented in the article, but there will always be various other contexts and stories which are missing, which completely change the nature of the story. So I suppose I wanted to kind of write that as a message as well. I wanted to, for a reader to read it and think, I know who this is because I've read about them in the papers and I've seen them on the news. And then slightly subvert that by showing the background, context, complexity of that person. And so I also wanted to try to take people into the family courts, which was a really hard thing because, unlike criminal cases or the criminal courts, the family courts are private. And to publish details of a family case is a contempt of court. So I'd signed up to this and then spent 3 months not sleeping, thinking, I don't think I can do it. And the way I got around it was kind of, I suppose, similar to the other cases where it's the theme which is important rather than the particular details. Although everything I write is true and happened, the details of the family case are all mixed up. So I took various elements of different family cases and kind of squashed them into a typical case, which I'm afraid was far easier to do than I had imagined because so often the same difficulties come up time and time again. So it's almost irrelevant whose case it was because it would be the same issues even if the faces were new. But there's been a big push to open up the family court since kind of 2014 when our recently retired president of the family division had made publication of anonymised judgments online possible. So you can, not very few people know about this, let alone act upon it, but you can go online and find anonymised judgments of a host of family cases. Ones that typical of the ones I write about. There are many more with all sorts of varieties online. And that in part was his way of trying to prevent some of the rumours that swirl around about the family courts, which I hear about. I think I say in the book that I'm usually quite reluctant to say I'm a family lawyer, in the same way I'm, I suppose, a doctor is quite reluctant on social occasions to say he's a doctor because he will be showing someone's corns sooner or later. But inevitably, you'll find people who've had a brush up with the family law. And but I did the other, I put my hand in the air the other day that when I was with some friends, and there was someone there I'd met for the first time, and he was telling everybody with great authority that the law says that what the mother wants counts more than what the father wants, and that's established in case law, and that's what all the judges believe. That's my hand sort of crept up, so it's not really right. But that kind of myth is allowed to take hold, and I think it's pretty well documented in the popular press as well, because we've kept the family court so secret. And now that there's a huge number of people representing themselves in the family court, I think hopefully I'm supported in this, or rather I support them in this, the very senior judges who say it's time to demystify it a bit and open it up a bit and make it a bit more accessible. So I wanted to write about those cases I had done in the family courts, which maybe busted some myths which I was coming up against quite a lot.
But you have got an unusual stance, as I understand it, in that you did practice in both crime
I did,
and
yeah,
family.
I did, yeah.
So why is that unusual, and why did you take that approach?
It's unusual because the more you do a particular type of law, say crime, the more popular you become usually, and so you're asked to do more. And the other kind of areas of law, if you're in a set like I am, which does all sorts of different kinds of law, get sort of squeezed out. And I had very small civil practice, which mainly paid my rent, and then the kind of legally aided crime was very poorly paid, but I loved it, and that's what I wanted to go to the bar to do, was to do criminal trials. So that is why I wouldn't let the clerks just fill my diary with family and some civil, which is what they wanted to do because it earned more money.
Yes.
But I loved the crime side of it.
And why? What appealed so much?
It was everything that I thought made a barrister,
in
as opposed
way?
To a solicitor or another kind of lawyer. I mean, apart from the costumes, which I'm very fond of. It is the baseline of humanity, I think.
Mm.
You know, genuinely, all life is there. Mm. And you meet people at a kind of a crisis point very regularly. You have sliding doors moments when you're in court, and you can see a person's life go one way or the other. And you're not changing the world or saving the world, but you are able at a particular moment in someone's life to make it easier for them,
mm.
and to help them with it. And that gives you a great sense of personal satisfaction, even if it's you're only kind of helping on a very small scale. It's a hugely rewarding experience, or not, or very saddening and devastating sometimes. But the highs are high and the lows are low, and that part is addictive.
Mm. But that's key from what comes out in your book, is that you are dealing, as you said, with a particular moment, and there are so many different factors in somebody's life leading them there, and
yeah.
also after they've received whatever judgment or whatever,
yes.
in the court, they're then out in the society again, and what you're presenting is that they're faced with all sorts of challenges. How do you react to that on an ongoing basis, seeing those frustrations over and over again in how people perhaps aren't getting the help or support?
It can be completely crushing, and I don't think I'm any different to anyone else who works in that particular area in the public sector. I think probation officers probably feel the same. I think people who work in prisons probably feel the same. I suspect people who work in the National Health Service feel the same when they see people coming back into A&E regularly, same kind of faces. That cycle is really hard to deal with because it makes you very frustrated. And I do believe in personal agency. I do think that to a degree some people have a choice, but also people, when they are faced with huge challenges, sometimes it's they are absolutely starting on the back foot.
Mm.
And what you get very frustrated by the kind of lack of holistic thinking between the various different arms of the public sector, and the lack of kind of joined up information sharing between people. That's frustrating.
So how do you feel that you've been affected by the cases that you've dealt with over the years, looking back over that 10-year period and having to think back on the cases that you've dealt with in putting the book together?
It's such an interesting question. I think it's really topical at the moment as well, because when I came to the bar, when I was called in 2005, the idea of kind of professionals having mental health problems, no one would say that, particularly not in at the bar. You just got on with it. And now there's a growing awareness, I think, that people who work in the public sector come up against all sorts of, you see difficult stuff, you deal with difficult people, and you have to grapple with life when it's hard for somebody else. And because we're self-employed, we're at a disadvantage in the sense that I know police officers, for example, can't work on indecent images cases for longer than, I can't remember how many months it is, but I think it's like 6 months, and then they're taken off it because it's so impactful. We don't have that.
Mm.
There was one barrister who I'm very fond of, who used to kind of announce that she didn't do any case unless it had a penis in it, because she just did back-to-back sex work all the time. And I think that's hugely affecting. You get what creeps into lots of the Rumpole books and others of his ilk is a kind of gallows humour, which the medical profession and now the police have as well, I suppose, as a coping strategy. But I think finally there's a growing awareness amongst, I think, people of my age, maybe the generation above, that looking at this kind of stuff does have an impact.
Mm.
And I've got to say that writing the book was basically like a therapy session. I'm not sure I could have written the observations I wrote about my own responses unless I wasn't doing it day in, day out. Because to do it, you put on an armour.
Mm.
And one of the narrative arcs of the book, in a way, is working out which side of the line to go down between being humane and being compassionate and caring for the person you're representing and protecting yourself from taking on too much guilt, responsibility, and your imagination working in overdrive to deal with all the kind of pain that you are witnessing. And it's a really delicate tightrope, because you can't, if you fall one side too much, then you're not doing your job properly. You can't be a robot and do it. You have to be able to be humane and compassionate, not just because your client deserves it, but you need to be able to put yourselves in the shoes of everybody that you cross-examine, because that helps you cross-examine. Mm. When your witness walks up, when your prosecution witness walks up, you've got about five seconds to work out how they're going to behave in cross-examination, and who they are fundamentally informs how you cross-examine them, and whether you're very soft with them or whether you're stricter with them or whatever it might be to get the best for your client. So you have to be empathetic, and you have to understand people and watch people carefully and know how they work and know how people respond. That is your jury speech often. Your jury speech is, put yourself in my client's shoes. What would you do? And if you're going to say that, you have to have done it yourself. So you have to be empathetic. But that does mean that you take on a lot of you take on a lot of other people's stuff. That working through that was very interesting. My editor was very helpful. She kept saying, well, sort of helpful and also torturous, because she kept going, but why did you react like that? Because I don't think you would have done. Why did you behave like that then? And so she was basically my shrink for a year, prodding me and getting me to think about how I responded to various situations and how I had grown up and walked down that tightrope for the last 10 years or so.
But also the cases that you dealt with, as I understand it, that the criminal cases are over in a shorter period of time, whereas the family cases can go on for years, that you're still meeting and dealing with those sort of people. That's and building up that relationship.
Yeah.
So, again, what was the toll, I suppose, that it made on you in dealing with those different cases? How did they affect you? Was family law more difficult?
Definitely more difficult, because everyone's a loser in a family case. You don't walk out. No one walks out really feeling like they've won. Even if your application has been granted, there will have been kind of concessions that you've had to make along the way. Mm. And also the law and the lawyers should try and get those concessions from you at every available opportunity, because a final hearing in a family court is really unpleasant. Not least because you have got, very often, I didn't really deal with money cases, I dealt with children cases, you've got the sort of ghosts of the children that you're dealing with there in the ether at the back of court, and that's what you're all there fighting about, and it's all too easy for everybody in the case to overlook them, even though they're ostensibly what you're supposed to be there for. So I found the family cases harder because I suppose I found it harder to maybe empathise with the people that I was representing. Although very, very often, and I think hopefully I kind of explore this in the book a bit, very often I would come away from it and think, how would I feel in their shoes? I'd fight that hard too, probably. So, you know, everybody comes with a context. I don't think our legal system helps the kind of people that I was representing who are fighting over their children. I think that our legal system fuels the flames a lot. Right from the beginning, when they're asked to kind of blame each other at the divorce stage. But by the time I would represent people in court, they will have been fighting for years and they would be very entrenched about it. And their views are very deeply held. It wasn't the, I don't think, very few people I think I've ever seen in the family case who've come to court to lie, they genuinely believe everything they're saying. So it's not easy.
So what do you hope that this book will contribute? You've had a lot of great reviews, and you've been and met a lot of people through festivals and whatnot, and you've already mentioned how you think that what we receive through the press and perhaps our own limited understanding of the law is skewed. So how do you hope that we're responding to your book?
Well, I should say that I think that one of the reasons I think that people don't understand about law is entirely the fault of lawyers for failing to explain it.
Yes.
And for making it kind of mysterious and exotic and glamorous when it's not. and, you know, from as simply as not really wanting to talk about money, barristers don't really like talking about money, the clerks do that, and we never give statements on the foot of steps of the court, it's the solicitors that do that. And, you know, we've kept, I think, normal life at an arm's pace, and I think that has done the law a great disservice, because when legal aid cuts and closures of courts and so on have taken place, everyone has thought, well, I mean, those are the fat cat ones, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Firstly, and also they haven't really understood why the law is relevant if you're not the one who's been burgled, or if you're not the one who's been arrested. Why on earth does the law have anything, any real meaning to you? So I think we have been very bad as a profession in explaining both what we do and why it touches everybody, no matter if they step into a courtroom or not. And so that at its most basic would be what I would hope to achieve, like for people who haven't really maybe even thought that much about the law, or have had a brush with it at some point but never really thought about other sides of the law, to read it and think, well, that maybe actually this does have an impact, whether it's the household insurance because of the huge burglary spree that's been going on, or whether it's the idea that they might lose their job and want to take their employer to court, or whether they might want to do Gina Miller and hold the government to account. Mm-hmm. That we expect it to be there like an umbrella that supports, that protects us from excessive powers and so on, and that taking it for granted is, and I mean that in the nicest way, I don't think that anyone's particularly to blame for this apart from the lawyers, but that we have sort of sleepwalked into a situation where no one really thinks the law is that relevant or worth supporting. And that means, of course, that we have a very, very tiny budget in terms of comparison to other governmental departments. It's very small. It wasn't ring-fenced. And we've had 7 secretaries of state in 10 years. So there's been a real, you know, it hasn't really been given any kind of credibility.
Yeah.
So
I'm going to say it. Okay, well, I've asked quite a few questions. Is there anything that anybody would like to ask? Yes?
Yes, it's leading on from your last point. Lord Chancellors were always lawyers, and of course the last few have not been.
No.
And so there have been many more changes. I mean, I think that's a retrograde step, because politicians become increasingly critical of judges. They don't seem to understand the judge's decisions.
Yeah.
They don't seem to understand about the separation of powers. And it just seems to me wrong that the Lord Chancellor is no longer a lawyer. I don't know what your view is on that.
Can you repeat the question?
Do I think it's wrong that the Lord Chancellor is no longer a lawyer? I think it would certainly help any Lord Chancellor if they understood why... about the law and its importance. But of course merging the position of Lord Chancellor with Secretary of State, I think, is a conflict in itself, because they have sort of opposing responsibilities, or protect their agendas are different to an extent, because I don't think that you have to. You know, I do think that there is protectionism in lots of industries. I do think that to walk into something as an outsider and to look at it completely differently from all those inside it and say, well, what about changing this? I don't think that that is necessarily a bad thing. I don't think I don't think you have to be, but I think for the Lord, I think the Lord Chancellor is such a different, it's such a different government, or it's not the same as Secretary. You've got a completely different lot of, set of responsibilities. Mm. I hope that, yes, I hope certainly that in terms of judges and trying to remedy the huge shortfall that we have, we can't find any, High Court judges. There's been 3 rounds with positions unfilled, and that is in part, I think, because you've got papers saying that they're enemies of the people. I mean, and also the changing nature of a judge's role now, if particularly at the district judge and circuit judge level, you're dealing with litigants and people all the time. So you're having to be in a family court. If you've got 2 people who are representing themselves, the protocol asks the judge to intervene for cross-examination, which is madness if you've then got to make a decision.
Mm. And but isn't the answer simply, as far as recruiting judges concerned, that actually pay too low?
Yeah.
Who's going to give up a £700,000 year practice?
Yeah.
To work for £150,000 a year.
And they used to call it the Purple Lifeboat, obviously, because people...
And it's a good pension, and it's great, and all of that stuff, but...
I completely agree. And I think that one of the things that used to make giving up that salary worthwhile, not that you would ever earn that much as a criminal barrister,
but
as a different kind of barrister, you might, but giving up that kind of salary to become a judge was only really worth it because of the great pension and the security.
Yes.
Of course, you don't get
and they've undermined the pension. Mm.
Yes, exactly. But I think it's multifaceted, like all complicated problems. It's not just the money. I do think it's the change in nature of the kind of jobs, the kind of cases they're having to do, the amount of paperwork that goes with it, the amount of administration that goes with it, and the amount of sort of credibility and respect that, you know, to have your, as the judges who who allowed junior minister application, to have their private lives picked over and then put on the front page. I mean, you think, what person voluntarily put themselves in that role when they're supposed to be seen as, they are absolutely neutral.
And they are absolutely.
They are absolutely neutral. Where else, genuinely, I don't think, in the world, can you say when you go to a courtroom that you are likely, not always, but very likely to be in front of somebody who is unbribable, uncorruptible, and will literally just apply the law. Mm-hmm. And if you don't agree with them, that you will probably have a route to go higher for it. But there aren't. I don't think that many countries that you can say that about.
But you can say it about our country.
You can. Mm-hmm. I mean, every time I watch a true crime American thing, like Make a Murder, I go... and I also go, that would never happen here. It would just not happen here. Mm. We are very...
Yeah, sorry, I didn't interrupt you.
Go on.
But that's a great asset of our legal system.
Yeah.
What changes, though, would you like to see in the justice system?
I think... if I could have kind of an immediate change, I don't think that money fixes everything, but I think that for certain things in the justice system, a bit of money would fix things very quickly, which is to remove means testing for legal aid, which we now have. So to go back to the situation that everybody is guaranteed, because that is a close sidestep away to American justice, where you get the person that you can afford to get. We haven't had that here, and we've always lauded that over America and said how, you know, our cab rank rule is the best in the world because you do the one that's coming up next. I would do that first and foremost. There are a few. I would reinstate pre-litigation advice in the family courts, which has been removed. So a large amount of the cases that come into the family courts shouldn't be there. But because they've never had access to a solicitor, they make the application and it's left to the judge to sort it out and say, well, this isn't this isn't shouldn't be in a courtroom which is paid for by the taxpayer in front of me, who is paid for by the taxpayer. So those are two, I think, relatively easy money steps to make. Apart from that, I mean, that's a question that's going to be, it's going to take a brave and ambitious Secretary of State to come in and sort out, because there are real problems with kind of access to justice in terms of the physical geographical nature of it. Mm. You have these incredibly, as far as I understand it, very expensive old buildings which are costing a huge amount of money to run, but just simply closing them down and not replacing it with anything has left huge amounts, left a genuine gap in terms of how people get to court, having to travel a large amount of a huge distance. So, I mean, James Mumby has come up. He's obviously family, but his suggestion, which some people balk at, but I can see merit in it, in local justice, is to have a mobile court. So you occupy a town hall or a space that is vacant locally, and you have some places that have the ability to have a secure dock, but I think this would probably only work if you didn't have to have a secure dock. And you have proper local justice, a bit like the old assizes that used to travel around and go to that. So, I mean, you cannot... What is so kind of mind-blowing when you get into the criminal law particularly, but it works in family as well, is that you get to court and you realise that you're the only one there. The prosecutor might be on their way, but they're reading through the other four cases that they've got into that morning, which they only just have got. The interpreter hasn't arrived because no one's booked them. And the prison van is not going to be there until 2 o'clock in the afternoon for a 10:30 hearing, which you probably wouldn't have gone in anyway because there's another 20 cases also listed at 10:30. So you're immediately kind of thrown into this quagmire of what happens in when you've got a huge amount of people and a large amount of problems, and not unlike at a business where you've got a kind of someone at the top who is pulling all the strings, you haven't got that. You've just got people in their own, trying to sort out their own sort of spheres. Of course, if your client's got to travel 2.5 hours in a bus to get to court by 10:30 or by 9:30, because you'll meet them an hour before the hearing, that makes the chances of them coming far less. So I think local justice is something which that needs to be looked at.
So where do we stand on video, I mean, there is a full process going through in the courts.
There is. So
establishing the kind of a video.
Yeah, whether courts are going to be transmitted.
How do you feel about
that? Well, there's two kind of different sectors to videoing. There's one which is that there is far greater use of videoed evidence now. So in a case where you have got a complainant in a sexual assault case or a rape case, their evidence will be videoed as close to their complaint as is possible, and that is the evidence which goes into court. They're on the table, they are talking about, and there are lots of practical problems about this, but they're talking about cross-examining, pre-recorded cross-examination, which of course anyone who's been involved in a defence trial will know presents some problems, because disclosure comes up throughout a trial all the time. And suddenly the police officer who had forgotten his notebook has suddenly found it with the comment that the defendant made straight afterwards. So, but there are ways around that, in that you could have a complainant at court if necessary. So the other idea which has been in the press recently, which you may be referring to, which is whether you're going to live stream cases. I think there's a real risk of turning real people's lives into entertainment, particularly given that that's what we do on Channel 5 and Channel 4 and Channel 3 is Love Island and Big Brother, and I've seen this in terms of, because I represented defendants who've been in prison, and I've been in court, and I've had conferences with them in a room while they've been on a telly and I've been here, and then we've had to take pleas and so on in court. And I've also cross-examined people who are not in the same courtroom because they're in a different room and they're being beamed in. And the experience is wholly different. People generally don't take it as with the same kind of gravity as you do in your own court. And, you know, particularly in the youth court and so on, if I'm representing someone who's kind of 14, 15, 16, and they're not in court, the environment, which is very sobering, even in a youth court, which is tables and not the big oak kind of panelled courtroom that you get in the Crown Court, it still it has a sort of sharpening of the mind in terms of, you know, grown-up people there watching you and expecting you to be serious about it. And I've done some extraordinary cross-examinations on video, Nick, where, and so I say that only because I wonder if that same effect will happen from the viewer's point of view when you're watching something which is a very serious, you know, going to impact on real people's lives in a very profound way, but you're sitting behind a telly watching it, whether that cheapens what's actually going on. But the counter argument I can also see, which is that if we're going to ensure our profession survives, we need to explain it to people and we need to open it up to people. And it's all very well saying to people, oh, you can walk into a Crown Court any day, just walk up the road, it's the best free theatre in the land, just pop in. But who does that, really, unless you've got a reason to, unless you're going into because you're studying for it, or many people, whatever. People don't go in. And so the action is sort of quietly going on behind the scenes, and there's been a huge disintegration in court reporting, so you don't get as many legal reports going on. So if we are going to say that we want to make sure that people understand why the legal system exists and what it's there to do, we need to find a way to bring it to people. I don't think that putting cameras in court is necessarily the way, but we need to find a way to bridge that gap.
Okay, we've got a question about that.
Firstly, I wanted to say, I think you said when you were talking that your aim was to shine a light on the back of the court rather than the front of the court, and I think you're very successful in doing that through the book. And in looking at the people and the cases that you cover, I have a younger sister who's a police officer. And she's often said to me that while we like to paint people in black and white as being inherently good and evil, in many of the situations where she's had to deal with people, they're often a sort of a victim of their own circumstance.
Yeah.
And that's my question for you, actually, and you're particularly with looking through the lens of criminal law.
Yeah.
Do you, in the cases that you're dealing with, are people... Is it a case of being inherently good or evil, good or evil, or is it more a case of being a victim of circumstances?
I don't think I've met that many people. I think I may have met one who I could say was kind of. I did meet a man once who, but no, of course not. And that, in a way, is exactly what I tried to do: is to say this weird challenge that you're given as a lawyer. You've got the law, which is literally black and white, and there may be caveats and exceptions, but you have to try and fit within that caveat and exception. And then you're given a person's life, which is various shades of grey, and somehow you've got to try and put these various shades of grey around the black and white and make it fit. And that's your challenge in court, is to try and do that. And And absolutely, that's what I wanted to try and do, is to say to people to look behind the headline. And although you know, I think when you go into it, most people would say that no one is born evil, and that is a kind of technical impossibility. But it's when you are asked the question, how can you possibly defend somebody who is guilty, which I've been asked twice this week already. Implicit in that is a feeling that someone is bad and evil and not worth beyond redemption. Implicit within that question is this idea that somebody is undefendable. So it is a good and worthwhile question, because reminding people that everybody is layered and complex is if that question continues to be asked, well, that should we should keep reminding that for as long as that question is asked, because I think they go hand in hand.
Sorry, the lady at the front.
It's very much around the... I chimed with very much what you said about the remoteness, but also the use of technology. I do a lot of work in public legal education, and the quality of legal literacy in this country is very poor, and I think in Suffolk particularly. And I think technology, the danger of technology, particularly for the 30% most vulnerable of the population, is actually going to make it more remote rather than less. We're seeing a situation where they're proposing for more offences to be to be dealt with on paper. And so the first time somebody might know that they've been found guilty of an offence is they'll receive a letter potentially from a bailiff. And certainly where I work, because I run a law centre, I run a separate law centre, often the first encounter that somebody has in the civil system is some paperwork telling them about a crisis, and actually not often one crisis, a multitude of crises, and they're just completely out of their depth. And the way that the law has worked to be very remote and very top down is very alienating to people, and in some ways it's deliberately made so. And I think the more we make it more remote by technology, the more we say that the law is somewhere in the ether rather than a person, you talk to a person, I think the worse it gets. I mean, even I've done telephone conferences. I do employment tribunals, and we do certain hearings on the telephone, and I'm partially deaf, and so that process becomes quite laborious. And when you've got several people talking, they've got no body language, and you can't see people speak. It's very difficult. And so if you've got video screens and the defendant in some prison watching a video, and you know, potentially, I think all of that becomes very problematic.
It's true, but that is absolutely true. But I, if you have been arrested for, or rather, if you've been charged with an offence, a sort of driving penalty offence or something like that, I know, because some of the clients I've represented have done this, but they arrive at court to find the court in the chaos that the court always is. They've had to take an entire day off work, and they don't get on until 4:30 in the afternoon, by which time they've had to phone their mum to come and pick up their kids from school. And the idea of being able to get a letter and do it, I know that some people I've represented would not, if they were given the option of not having to go through the not this very, also the kind of emotionally draining process of psyching yourself up to walk through the security doors and go into the process of a court for something which I mean, obviously it all boils down to exactly what it is, the offence is, and how people kind of feel about that. And it's, I've also done telephone practice in the civil side of it, and most civil cases can't believe that, I mean, civil lawyers can't believe that the criminal side hasn't introduced it yet, because I have done cases in the civil side which of course have impacts on people's lives, because we're talking about people suing employers or for all sorts of loss of earnings and so on. And I will be in front of a judge on a phone, wherever I may be, and it's done very quickly.
Yeah, exactly.
And so there is, I think we need to be careful about saying no change ever.
No.
And careful about saying that we shouldn't look at how other places do it, because that's always a useful exercise. But I think clearly the thing to bear in mind always is what is the impact, the impact upon someone's life about not having information is profound. But that, I think, comes back to paying for people to have advice. Always.
Mm-hmm. We're running out of time, and the gentleman there.
Sorry,
keep it quick.
I'll try and make it quick.
Thank you.
I just had the impression from just looking briefly at your book, and I'm sorry, I haven't read it, but that's my world. Was that you have a very humane approach to the people you're dealing with, and people come alive, and maybe they are sort of patchworks of lots of different people, but they come alive as people you can recognise, and you think, wow, a lawyer is recognising this person as who they are. This seems my initial reaction is it seems unusual. It's not how I imagine lawyers. Do you find that the profession is like that now, or are you unusual?
I've had one of the chapters, the first chapter was serialised in The Guardian, and I had, I think, 10 letters from people, some of whom said that I'd written about them. Not literally, but they went, I recognise the person that you write about because that was once me, and now I'm doing this or that or whatever. And other people, an amazing chap who used to be a police officer, he wrote to me and said how often he recognised the person that I wrote about as well. And I had a message from a woman who'd been through a very fractious separation with her ex-husband and had been through the courts fighting about their children, and she said, they all said, what a relief to know that there is all this stuff that's going on behind the scenes. But the difficulty is when you're in your professional mode, you're doing that tightrope game, mm-hmm. where you can't tell or show what you may be thinking or feeling. Because you're not there to feel sorry for them, you're there to help them. And I was watching actually the BBC programme, The Prosecutors, which is really interesting. It's been replaced by another one, but they've got three on BBC iPlayer, and one of the prosecutors who worked in-house at CPS said how difficult it is to deal with a family after you've done a murder trial and you go back in and talk to the family. And she said, obviously, you can't cry because it's not your pain, it's their pain. You save that for the car home. Mm-hmm. And that's my personal experience, and that's the experience of many of my colleagues. Mm-hmm. But you cannot expose, it's indulgent in a way to show those emotions to your client, because that's not what you're there to help them.
I suppose the question was, do you feel when you're talking to your clients behind the scenes, not talking to your clients, talking to your colleagues behind the scenes, is that everybody has the same engagement with their clients, people they're representing, or I was thinking of it's an older generation where everybody...
I think you're right, I think you're right, there's an older generation who is just a bit more distant. I know people who wouldn't go to the cells to meet their clients. They'd send the solicitor, and the first time they saw their clients when he was in the dock and they were in court, they just wouldn't go down there.
Can I just put the solicitor's point of view? Because I'm a solicitor. And I think that solicitors have a greater engagement with their clients.
Yeah,
no,
you're the buffer.
Really asking, and sorry, I really wanted to hear Sarah's view.
Well, she's a barrister.
And
there is a difference between barristers and solicitors.
Of course, I know that. I'd like to know Sarah's.
The gentleman's right in it. The solicitors are the buffer, so they're allowed to be closer. They're allowed to say, "I'm going to phone your mum. Yeah. I'm going to do all that kind of stuff." I think you have to take. I took it on a case, or almost on a case by case basis, because you have to read your client and work out how they're going to respond to you.
Mm-hmm.
What I don't know if you've seen The Children Act or read it, the Ian McEwan film, and there's a moment which really troubled me in the book, but then sort of didn't trouble me as much when I watched on the film, which is when where the boy kisses her at the end, towards the end, sorry about the spoiler. And in some ways, you know, one of the things that troubled so many people in their reviewing it is that she had crossed a line of intimacy by allowing the relationship between her and this boy that she was deciding his fate, and she'd allowed it to go kind of beyond that. And to an extent, that's that kind of battle that you do with all of your cases. You work out how much your client can take about knowing who you are. And so particularly with some of my younger clients, and I was in the youth court quite a lot, I would be definitely kind of more open, because I feel that they needed it more. I speak about one 11-year-old who I represented, who I used to play papers and stone with under the desk, because it was the only way of keeping his attention while we waited for the magistrates to come in. And, you know, I'd never do that with an adult or anyone like that. But you have I felt I was able to have that kind of intimacy without him thinking that I was someone other than I wasn't.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't impose any kind of, that I wouldn't turn into a social worker or someone else. But, and with other clients, you absolutely don't want to let them in.
Mm-hmm.
You know that you, because they may be so volatile and so emotional, you have to dial down your own response to them to become incredibly, you pull back quite a lot. And partly to kind of keep them stable.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're, in terms of generational difference, yes, I think you're right. I think that our generation is, and I base this only on people I know, there's no other basis for it than observation, that we are able to be a little bit more emotional about our clients. Certainly, my friends of mine here at the bar, we absolutely talk about our clients in very humane ways. But I think the generation above, maybe held in slightly, at a slightly kind of further distance. But that, in a way, plays into exactly what we started talking about right at the beginning, which is a sort of an openness about areas that used to be very closed, medicine being one.
Mm-hmm.
And there is now a swathe. I was reading about the firefighter who's just published his book relatively recently, and you know, we've got a swathe of people who are working in the public sector who are able to admit their own emotional response to it in a way that maybe wouldn't have happened a decade ago, I think.
Mm-hmm. But we have run out of time, so just quickly, what happens next for you? I mean, you're still doing lots of events, lots of panel discussions about the subject generally, not just promoting the book, but but what's next for you?
Well, my clerks think I'm coming back in January. My editor thinks I'm going to write another book.
Right.
So I just need to get those two together and they can fight it out.
Okay, so we've got to watch this space.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we better close it now. But Sarah will be here for a little while to sign books, and you can chat briefly with her then. But I know we've all got so many questions, and it's been fascinating. And the
Thank
book
you very
is
much
wonderful.
Me.
So if you haven't read the book yet, then please do. It's so accessible. And you mentioned earlier that you might be taking it on a university tour. Or
yeah, I think
students.
So. For the paperback. Yeah.
Which I think will be great, because it's a very readable and
beautiful,
very accessible
book.
And
thank
yes,
you.
Useful
thank
book.
You very much.
So thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you for having me. It's
and
been a real treat.
It's been lovely.
Thank you.